Welcome to On the Brink Radio, broadcast number 223. This is Jeff Phillips Wefersonian. I'm recording this show from the top of Totoko Okahokura. It's a little island or a large rock at the south end of Arafura Beach here on Aotea, Great Barrier Island, New Zealand. It's the afternoon of the 9th of November, Thursday, 2017, about 6 p.m. This show is in honor of my beautiful friends, the whales and dolphins, and the name that I've learned how to say in Māori for how I feel about Aotea, this island, a sacred place of guidance from the whales and dolphins. He wahi tapu, wahi arahi mai, ingia tohora magnia aihi. I'd like to thank Grandmother Curie Dews, founder of the 13 Grandmothers Down Under, for translating that. I've shared this story before. Arafura, which is the true Māori name of this beach that the Europeans call Madelines, he was the high priest of the Takatimu Waka, which was the last wave of migration of the Polynesian ancestors who traveled by boat across the Pacific Ocean. Some people believe from Rapa Nui, Easter Island. Some people believe from Peru. Some people believe from possibly the remnants of Atlantis or Lemuria. Who knows? But the story goes that he was guided across the Pacific Ocean by seven tohora, seven southern right whales, accompanied him and guided him all the way across, straight to this bay where I am right now. And he was so thankful to these whales. The very first thing he did when he came ashore was he came up on this rock where I am right now, possibly even at the very spot where I'm standing, because I'm at the highest point, which is facing northwest, and there's a rocky outcropping. It looks like a perfect place. There's even a rock that looks kind of like a little altar or place that you could sit. I've got my painted rocks and flute and drum on there right now. He spread his cape and made a special offering or blessing in honor of and in gratitude to the seven right whales that guided him on his journey. And so I feel, because of my really powerful encounters with dolphins and more recently humpback whales, more from a distance, but the most powerful encounters with cetaceans I've ever had have been here at this very beach. And so this is my last show on Aotea for this visit. I've been here, I guess, about 2 months, and it's been ultra fantastic. This has been one of my most powerful, productive, and rich and full visits here. I've got more artwork done than ever before, but done more outdoor activities, caught up on a lot of rest and healing, did some very good physical activities, like a long, strenuous bicycle ride, climbed the highest peak, did a fairly long, strenuous coastal walk along some cliffs, went swimming in the ocean just about every single day. It's just been an amazing visit. But in honor of my love of the whales and dolphins, this show is dedicated to them. And in recent shows, I've tried to talk about the real global threats to their well-being, because it's my work with the whales and dolphins, in terms of my research and activism, is kind of in two parts. One part is trying to understand who they are as fellow beings. That's a whole endeavor in itself. And the other part is trying to map out in a acutely critical, full-spectrum way of determining and analyzing and explicating what the real global threats to their well-being are, which many of these threats would apply to any life forms that live in the ocean. And to me, that's one of the most urgent areas that we need to be paying attention to. It's a subset of the war that our military-industrial civilization is waging on all of life, including ourselves and including our planet Mother Earth. But the whales and dolphins are, to me, the most special beings on this planet. And I'm not putting them on a pedestal or isolating them out from my whole family of life. Me to Kaya, yes, and I love everybody, all the kingdoms of life, especially my visit here, the kingdom of the birds. Oh my God, I've had little birds come in my cottage every day, about five different kinds. The honeybees, beautiful little encounters with them. The plant kingdom, oh my God, grandmother Pahutukawa, and my go-to colas and the heliconias and my sacred white sage grown by Michael Girardello in Victoria, and grandmother Pahutukawa tree and all of her family, and all the cabbage trees and the nikaus and the cowrie trees, and the beautiful pink flowers on the dunes that a lot of people think are weeds, but they're the most beautiful colors here. It's just such a beautiful nature place, but overriding the whole spirit of this island is, to me, that it's a sacred place of guidance from the whales and dolphins. And the reason I think that they're so special is not to make a direct comparison with us, although it's really all we can do is think in terms of ourselves when we try to look at other beings. But from what we know, they've been on this planet, Mother Earth, a lot longer than we have, having returned to the ocean from being living on land for a long time, 30 million years ago. And if there's any reality to a correlation between consciousness and mentality, cognitive ability, the I-word intelligence, if there's any correlation between neurobiology and those revered attributes that we project our superiority in them onto, creating a scale of measurement of other beings. If there's anything to the neurobiological and consciousness correlation, the whales and dolphins have far more sophisticated brains and nervous systems than we do, and would therefore be very likely to have minds and cognition and psychological faculties light years beyond us. And that's really hard for us to imagine, because if we can't experience it ourselves, how could we possibly know what it is? I mean, that's where one of my very favorite quotes from Einstein: imagination is more powerful than knowledge. And I really understand what he meant by that, I think. But to enter the realm of the consciousness of the whales and dolphins, I think that we're able to tune into their spirit and their noospheric continuum all the time if we're not blocking it out, in the same way that we're able to feel the consciousness of Mother Earth. And I think that they're related. And all this ties back to an idea that I talked about in the show I recorded about 3 weeks ago about computers as a form of extraterrestrial intelligence. The basic idea in that is really not about computers or electronic entities, but about how the whales and dolphins, according to John Lilly's vision, are in constant real-time, very deep communication, or, you know, whatever word you want to use, they're in touch with water-based life on other planets in other star systems, possibly other galaxies. Now, Lilly never really elaborated in any greater depth on what he envisioned or experienced, but it'd be very interesting to go down that road a little bit, and I think the whales and dolphins might be able to tell us ourselves. And I'm not necessarily looking for information about other Earth-like planets that might have life and whales and dolphins. That's what NASA and all the exobiology going into space people are trying to do. But they're looking at it from the perspective of not going to a garden and taking only photographs and leaving only footprints. They're looking at any place like the moon or Mars as stepping stones to further destinations where they're going to mine out and extract all the resources and terraform the places with nuclear explosions and engineer the atmosphere and release genetically engineered life forms everywhere. And I'm not making all this up. I've read all of those as ideas from different people, as either part of an agenda or recommendations for how we should approach our imminent arrival on other worlds. But I think it's all a part of the Koyaanisqatsi insanity syndrome. I think that humanity as a whole right now is very seriously demented in terms of our true consciousness. And I think that our true consciousness, our true nature, is very, very, very much like the whales and dolphins. But we're the ones that have mutated for thousands of years and lost touch with who we really are, whereas they haven't. They're paying a very big price by trying to continue to live in an ocean that's increasingly industrialized and militarized with every form of military and industrial technology that I spend a lot of time on this show trying to uncover and research and investigate and understand myself and convey this to other people. But it's quite scary, and a lot of people really are afraid of venturing into looking at anything that has to do with the military. It's like they've been conditioned or brainwashed to switch off, to not question it. It's something that we're not meant to question, the military. Yet it's the largest albatross around all of our necks, the most greatest lead weight of environmental catastrophe everywhere. And the military in general is exempt from any environmental regulations. They can destroy, leave waste and poison everywhere. And this is just if they just go there. This is regardless of whether they're even doing anything. Just their mere presence. Like Terry Lilly talks about how wherever naval ships go, destroyers and stuff, everything just dies in the vicinity. Even if they aren't fighting a war or doing war games. It's just the energetic and chemical and radiological microwave electromagnetic emissions that these things put out. This is the kind of next generation of alpha and beta warfare. Alpha would be deliberate, direct, and premeditated. And beta warfare would be sort of the involuntary side effects or collateral damage from just the existence or presence of military vessels and technologies. So really the reality is a combination of the two. I'll share my encounters with dolphins here. First was in, I think it was 2009, when my former partner Elizabeth Verstraeten and I were out swimming in the ocean, and we were in water about up to our chest and just having a good time, and all of a sudden these three dolphins came. Oh, they came up about to within a meter of us, and we were just amazed because I had met some dolphins before, but never when I was swimming. And Lisbeth had never actually met any before, ever. And they came right up. They came right to us. Like they were very interested and hung around us. And it was like they were zapping us with this really cool energy. Then they left, and then they came back, and then they left, and then they came back. And they did that two or three times. After about an hour, hour and a half, they left. But then Lisbeth and I got out of the water, we were just absolutely blown away. And we looked at each other and we just go like, wow. We both felt totally exhilarated physically, like we'd just been uplifted and energized and healed by some kind of amazing, I don't think it was sonar necessarily, it might have been a component of it, but it was some kind of energy that they are able to share. It's like they gave us a treatment. But then we also looked at each other and go, oh my God, do you feel that? And we both agreed that we did. We felt a very profound sense of urgency or a warning, as if the dolphins had imparted a sense of warning about something really big and terrible, like some kind of giant planetary environmental catastrophe that was going to happen soon, but that had not happened yet. This is what we both sort of thought that we had intuited or had communicated to us. And a few months later is when the Christchurch quake happened and then Fukushima. And we wondered if that might be what they were talking about, but I think we sort of agreed that what they were talking about was even going to be a lot bigger than that, like actually fully planetary. So that was in 2009, maybe 2010. So in 2015, in November, just about this time of year, there was a pod of dolphins that came around here. I'd seen them over at Haratonga and asked them if they would come over, and they did. The next day they were here, and they hung out for like about a week, and there was about, maybe 6 or 8 or 10 or 12 of them. And one day, I was standing in water right by Memory Island, standing in water about knee-deep, and all of a sudden, I was looking at the dolphins swimming back and forth, and all of a sudden, two of them surfed in on a wave and went right on either side of me, like about less than a meter to my left and a meter to my right. And the one on the right sort of turned around and went back out. And the one on the left, which I felt like was a female, she laid there in the water that was only about less than half a meter deep, right beside me, and turned upside down and was looking at me, just laying there. And the beautiful sunlight shining down, and the awesome shape of her body, so streamlined, and just, I'll just never forget that image. And she stayed there for like, I don't know, 30 seconds or so, and I just didn't try to touch her or anything like that, but I was absolutely blown away. It was just a gift of beauty. And then I went back and to my art table, and I painted a t-shirt that where I just painted the shape of the dolphins on a white t-shirt from my friend Peggy Ann Garlick. But that shape was just so beautiful and graceful, but the shape of that dolphin went right into the t-shirt. And then during that same time period, I was out there filming them, and I was in water all over my waist and with my video camera filming the dolphins, and they weren't exactly surfing on the waves, but when a wave would come, they would get on top of it, and then they would shoot sideways down through the wave, as if the wave was a tube, only under the water, not like a surfer would do, but they would shoot down through the wave itself, through the water, but so fast, just for a split second, a couple of seconds, they would just accelerate to, oh my God, you can't believe how fast, and they just kept doing that like it was just this fun exercise. I got video footage of that somewhere, and on that morning, I had to get out and go and ride my bicycle to a meeting with the council about some environmental issues, some of which had to do with the dolphins. But just about 2 or 3 days before that was, I'd been out there with the dolphins, and I came back to my art table and was painting, and all of a sudden this image appeared in my mind, and I just drew it down. Drew a picture of it, and I go, oh my God. And it was like, what it was an image of an impression of what a comet or asteroid might look like for a split second as it's coming through the atmosphere, coming straight toward whoever's looking at it. It was kind of circular with rays coming out. And it just blew me away, because that's what the image was. I knew that's what it was supposed to be. And I'm sure it was transmitted by the dolphins. And in my mind, I went, they've seen that before, their ancestors, it's in their collective memory. But not only did their ancestors see it at least once, but the implication was that something like this might be on the verge of happening again. And that's what really blew me away. Well, I'd already been really interested in comets and asteroids, but that put it at the next level. So then, just a few months ago, after visiting Malcolm Hartley, the comet researcher at the Siding Spring Observatory and the Warm Bowls in New South Wales, I learned that from the work of Victor Klug and Bill Napier, they were two comet researchers that put forth the idea of that it was a giant asteroid or comet impact that triggered the mass extinction event of 65 million years ago. And then it was picked up and more popularized by the Alvarez brothers. But Klug and Napier said that they thought that it was a fragment of Comet Encke, that's E-N-C-K-E, a comet that broke up due to various gravitational reasons, and that its fragments are orbiting the Sun, and that twice a year the Earth's orbit passes through the orbit of these fragments. And there's two windows of time, one in late June and early July, and the other in late October and early November, where we are right now. And this is the most likely time when the Earth might be impacted by a fragment of Comet Encke. And it was in this exact window of time, late October, early November, when the dolphins transmitted that image to me. So it's very interesting synchronicity. I think the whales and dolphins, I love them, and it's really hard to imagine what it would be like to be them. But they don't talk. They communicate. They use sound, but they don't use language. And a big part of my work with them, it's not really about them, but it's about us. It's about the limits of our own understanding, the beliefs and attitudes that we have that stand in the way of the true understanding, the fact that we're living in a totally artificial military-industrial civilization that by its very nature is rooted in war on the earth and life. And people just don't understand that. And so when I was working with Dr. John Lilly's Dolphin Communication Group back in 1980-81, my main interest was in using music as a form of communication. And I was working on some really cool projects. And I'll never forget the time they let me go there. Joe and Rosie, their dolphins that came to visit, had only been there about a month, and they invited me over to the lab to swim with them, and I was able to play some recorded music to them through the underwater computer system that changed the frequency range of sound from our range into theirs and vice versa in real time, so that they could actually hear the sounds that we made in a way that was more approximate to how it would sound to us, and vice versa. I mean, there's no way to really know what anything sounds like to somebody else, especially of another species, but it was an attempt to bridge the physical communication barrier. But I was in the water, and they put the music on. It was some Pat Metheny from his White album, and some Ralph Towner Solstice from the first Solstice album from 1976, a song called Oceanus. And the Pat Metheny song was called San Lorenzo. And as soon as the music started playing, the dolphins, they had been kind of frolicking around and stuff, and as soon as the music started, they stopped what they were doing and just floated there. And they got this really amazing, blissful look in their eyes, as if they loved the music and like they could feel or hear it with their whole body. And I could kind of hear the music, kind of muffled because I was underwater. But it was just one of the coolest moments of my life. I knew how much that they loved the music, and they had probably never heard anything like that before. I might be the first person to play pre-recorded jazz music to whales and dolphins at their own frequency range underwater. It was a legendary moment. And so I was really interested in using music as a form of communication and working on some really cool projects until around the mid-90s, when it started really dawning on me the gravity of the war that we're waging on them. Acoustically, for example, And I went like, how is it possible for us to have a musical dialogue and musical exchanges with beings that we're doing our best to wage war on and making it almost impossible for them to live and have a normal life? So I sort of put all my musical projects on the back burner and devoted myself full time to exploring and understanding and creating awareness about the real global threats to the whales and dolphins. And that's where my work has focused ever since. And this show is an attempt to talk about the big picture that I'm really trying to convey in my series of Beyond films, that that project has been on the back burner too for the past few months, especially since my Nikon camera got destroyed by the ocean in Tasmania back in February, and I'm busting my ass to try to get a new one. But the new one will shoot HD video, which will make it a very, very powerful tool. But I've got a couple of marine biologist friends that are going to let me use a lot of their underwater footage, and the soundtrack is going to be equally as important as anything that you see. But the films are going to be, there's probably going to be at least 7 or 8 of them, focusing on different aspects. And I was talking with my friends at Stranded No More just the other day. They were speculating on, you know, people make really nice documentaries about whales, but they never make a documentary about stranded whales. They have made a film about captive whales. That's a big trendy area of focus, captivity. And they've made a film about the cove, the dolphins being killed by the Japanese. And then you've got the Sea Shepherd reality TV show of the battling the evil Japanese whalers, but that's about it. Then you've got a few docos that show underwater footage. But it's really bizarre because invariably, you're going to hear the narrator say, they're such beautiful animals. And they're such, now this is the one you always hear, they're magnificent creatures. Just absolutely magnificent. And then you know, as soon as you hear those catchphrases, that probably somewhere in that sentence or in the next sentence or two, there's going to be some kind of connection with climate change. This is sort of how it all works. So my Beyond films aren't going to be anything like that. Some of it's going to be, I mean, I'm not making these films for entertainment purposes. I mean, it's going to be my very best artistic, musical, audiovisual, information activism synthesis. And guided by the whales and dolphins themselves, as they are guiding me to share these things with you right now. But I think of them as a true extraterrestrial intelligence. That has nothing to do with beings from space, except that we're in space. But terrestrial meaning from land. They don't live on land, so they're extraterrestrial. And I also think of them as the ultimate indigenous people. And this is why it's been so powerful being invited into whale dreaming consciousness by the indigenous people of Australia over the past 3 years. That's just a really, really amazing connection. And the connection I just had in the central desert, where my friend Kara Tupley shared with me that the Pitjantjatjara medicine man that she knows, or that a friend of hers knows, said that there's actually water holes in the center of the desert way out there where whales can come up, as if they can travel underneath all of Australia through underground water systems, caverns, underground oceans, or something like that, and come up to these holes where they can come out. I don't know if they're big enough for them to breach, but where they can have a look around, maybe share something with the people there. I mean, imagine how cool that would be. I just did that in a painting. A really cool painting with Uluru and Katajuta and a waterhole with whales and dolphins jumping up out of it to look at the stars. And it's got the Daughter of the Rainbow Serpent. This painting is from my friend Austin Hill back in Asheville, North Carolina. Hey, Wahi Tapu, Wahi Arahi Mai. Inya Tahora Mangya Ai, a sacred place of guidance from the whales and dolphins. Well, I'm sad to be leaving Aotea. It's been a beautiful, powerful time here, but I'll be going to Auckland, then to the South Island for a month, and then back to Tasmania and to Australia, up the East Coast, and probably back to the Central Desert and paint some more murals at the YHA in Alice Springs there. But try to tune into the whales and dolphins. If you really love them, they know. They're trying to share their wisdom and knowledge with us all the time. It's really interesting speculating on the connection between the whales and dolphins' connection with water-based life here and on other planets, and the indigenous people of Australia, their connection with water-based life, and the ancient Dreamtime ancestors, and the maintenance of the life forms, and what all the sacred ceremonies of the Dreamtime, how they work and what they're about, and their art, and the beautiful consciousness of the whales and dolphins. And I've really been exploring all the connections here and their ancient memories of cosmic catastrophes and what might be coming again soon that they can either sense or predict based on their memories. All this is very interesting areas for speculation and for imaginative creativity. But I've come up with a sort of a mega hypothesis. It's called the Cetacean Keringi Lawler Lily Narber Velikovsky hypothesis, and I recorded a radio show about it. It's about the connection between the whales and dolphins, the visual art of the Central Desert people of Australia, for example, the Keringi group, my friends Kathleen Wallace and Serena Hayes, the work of Robert Lawler, who wrote Voices of the First Day, the work of John Lilly, who I've talked about at length, the work of Jeremy Narby, anthropologist and researcher, his books, The Cosmic Serpent, DNA and the Quest for Knowledge, and Intelligence in Nature, very essential reading, and Emmanuel Velikovsky, the Mac Daddy of Catastrophism. Anyway, this is Jeff Phillips Wefferson signing off from Totoko Kahakura. Many blessings and hope to see you soon. And live simply so that others may simply live, so that the people of one heart of all the kingdoms of life might be nurtured as the seeds of the new creation.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.